The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media. The Triangle Radio Reading Service would like to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we're reading this week from the March 3rd, 2017 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Trump taps McMaster as National Security Advisor. What happened? President Trump this week named the widely respected Army Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster as his new National Security Advisor in an effort to steady a foreign policy team roiled by Michael Flynn's ouster for lying about his conversations with Russian officials. A bluntly outspoken military tactician, McMaster, 54, accepted the post after retired Navy Vice Admiral Robert Harward turned it down out of concern that he could not bring in his own team. In a rollout at his Mar-a-Lago estate, Trump praised the new hire as a man of tremendous talent and tremendous experience. McMaster holds a doctorate in military history from the University of North Carolina and became famous within the Army for leading a 9-tank assault that destroyed more than 80 Iraqi tanks and armed vehicles in the 1991 Gulf War. His 1997 book, Dereliction of Duty, was a scathing critique of U.S. military leaders who refused to push back against President Lyndon Johnson's disastrous escalation of the Vietnam War. During the Iraq War, McMaster's counterinsurgency efforts secured the key city of Tal Afar and served as a template for General David Petraeus' surge of 2007. Known for his humane treatment of detainees, McMaster ordered soldiers never to speak of Muslims in derogatory terms. I look forward to joining the national security team and doing everything I can to advance and protect the interests of the American people, McMaster said. White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer said that McMaster has full authority to structure the national security team the way he wants. The selection won praise from Trump's critics on both sides of the aisle. Republican Senator John McCain lauded McMaster's genuine intellect, character, and ability. Democratic Representative Adam Schiff, ranking member of the House Intelligence Committee, tweeted that the general wrote the book on the importance of standing up and may need to show the same independence here. What the editorial said: McMaster is an enlightened choice who could be a moderating force in an administration packed with radicals and amateurs, said the New York Times. The key to his Iraq war success was simple yet revolutionary, treating Iraqis with dignity and deference and protecting civilians from murderous insurgents. McMaster also speaks of the terrorist threat with nuance and restraint, careful not to brand all Muslims as a menace. A welcome contrast to the hysteria that fueled Trump's travel ban. If Trump wanted a yes man to head the National Security Council, he has picked the wrong general, said the Wall Street Journal. The only question is whether McMaster can step out of his military background to become a foreign policy strategist. Someone in this White House, hopefully not ultra-nationalist Stephen Bannon, must devise a strategy for reclaiming American influence from the encroachment of China, Russia, and Iran in Asia, Europe, and the Middle East. This means turning Mr. Trump's America First instincts into policies that don't merely mimic President Obama's strategic retreat. What the columnist said: the new NSA chief is no Michael Flynn, and that's a good thing, said Jennifer Rubin in the Washington Post. McMaster won't cozy up to Russia, brand NATO a burden, or indict the entire Muslim world. His success depends on quarantining Stephen Bannon and teaming up with other adults in the administration, like Defense Secretary Jim Mattis and Homeland Security's John Kelly. That still leaves the problem of Trump's judgment, conflicts of interest, honesty, and impulsivity, but at least the foreign policy apparatus won't be the cause of his failures. McMaster is widely viewed as the Army's smartest officer, said Fred Kaplan in Slate.com. He becomes NSA chief with the most rigorous judgment of anyone who's taken the job in decades and is renowned for speaking truth to power. McMaster inherits a National Security Council in deep disarray, said James Kitfield in Politico.com. He also enters a White House with competing power players who have sharp elbows and closer ties to the president, such as Bannon, who actually got himself on the NSC. At some point, the forthright McMaster will tell the president something he doesn't want to hear, and retired Army Major Mike Lyons in TheHill.com. That's when we'll find out if the Trump administration confuses moral courage with loyalty. And before we move on from here, there's a short in the wasn't all bad section. They call Zhang Hexian Kung Fu Grandma. A social media sensation in China, the diminutive 93-year-old from eastern Zhejiang province has been practicing the martial art since age 4. At the time, her country was at war, Zhang explains, so it was a good way to learn self-defense. She has since mastered a form of kung fu that encompasses 15 styles, each with 36 moves, and now teaches the skill to others in her village. Zhang, who boasts that she's never been to a hospital, credits kung fu with keeping her healthy. To have good body, she says, you need to exercise and keep a positive attitude. Our controversy of the week. The press. Are journalists the enemy of the people? The adversarial relationship between the press and president is as old as the Republic itself, said John Finer in TheAtlantic.com. But President Trump's constant attacks on the press as an institution, which escalated sharply last week, are something new and potentially dangerous for our democracy. At a wildly combative White House press conference, Trump loudly berated reporters as dishonest peddlers of fake news and said the press is out of control. Perhaps most chilling, though, was a tweet in which the president labeled the mainstream media the enemy of the American people. This snappy phrase has an ugly history, said Will Bunch in the Philadelphia Daily News. Hitler, Mao, and Lenin all used enemies of the people to discredit and incite violence against anyone who dared to question their authority. As Republican Senator John McCain put it this week, attacking the legitimacy of the free press is how dictators get started. Let's not overreact, said Jack Schaefer in Politico.com. There is no more consistent political tradition in America than presidents delegitimizing the press. FDR once gave a reporter a dunce's hat and told him to sit in the corner. President John Adams signed the Alien and Sedition Acts, which made false criticism of his government a crime. President Trump is simply putting the press on notice, said Michael Goodwin in NYPost.com. He is calling out biased reporters for trying to destroy his presidency and is making it clear that if journalists behave like opponents, he will treat them like opponents, punching back harder than they punch him. Sorry, but Trump's attack on the press is both unprecedented and ominous, said James Fallows in TheAtlantic.com. Other presidents have complained about how they've been covered by the media. Trump is essentially claiming the media has no right to ask him questions he'd rather not answer, or to write stories he deems negative and unfair. In his black and white way, he actually thinks the entire media should turn into a propaganda organ like Fox News, which Trump called very honorable. His goals are more sinister even than that, said Brett Stevens in Time. When the press catches him in one of his many lies, such as his claim that millions of people illegally voted in the election, Trump always responds, "Well, that's what many people say." This is an Orwellian attack on not just the media, but also the idea of objectivity itself. Trump wants to be president of a nation where there is no such thing as truth. If so, his plan isn't working, said Lloyd Grove in the DailyBeast.com. The departure last week of National Security Advisor Michael Flynn was the direct result of aggressive reporting by the New York Times and the Washington Post, which have only just begun to dig into the tangle of secrets, chaos, and corruption in the White House. If anything, journalism is an institution, as an institution, has reasserted itself in the age of Trump. It badly needs to, said Linda Feldman in CSMonitor.com. Even though major newspapers and websites report that circulation and traffic are surging because of interest in Trump, polls find that trust in the media is still at an all-time low. How journalists respond to Trump's open hostility and to his norm-shattering approach to governing will go a long way toward determining how the public sees the press. It is a biased meddler. Is it a biased meddler or an essential pillar of an American democracy? Well, it was a good week for rest and relaxation. After President Trump, who repeatedly lambasted Barack Obama for playing golf while president, played six rounds of golf in Florida during his first month in office. His staff taped up a window with black plastic to prevent reporters from seeing Trump on the course. It was a good week for rave reviews after a modest roadside cafe in central France was inundated with new customers after mistakenly being awarded the coveted Michelin star intended for an expensive restaurant of the same name. "I put my heart into my cooking," said the delighted chef of the wrong La Bouche Aurelle. And it was a good week for Ivanka Trump, whose signature perfume became the top-selling fragrance on Amazon.com, as Trump supporters responded to a boycott of her products by Trump critics. But it was a bad week for oversharing after a California woman donated her husband's old shirt to a local Goodwill only to discover that he'd hidden $8,000 he'd been saving for a surprise vacation in the pocket. "He was crying," Linda Hoffman said of her husband's reaction. Fortunately, a Goodwill employee returned the cash. It was a bad week for authors, with the news that publishers are hiring sensitivity readers to screen books for content about race, religion, gender, and sexual orientation someone might find offensive. And it was a bad week for skipping the chores after a Pennsylvania college student received a package from his mother filled with garbage he had neglected to take out during a home visit. Connor Cox said his mom knows what to say at the exact time she should say it. The title of our briefing page article this week, America's Military Challenges. President Trump inherited several undeclared wars around the world. Will he change U.S. policy? Where is the U.S. currently fighting? President Trump is now overseeing several ongoing combat operations that began during previous administrations. Some 8,400 U.S. troops are still deployed in Afghanistan, the longest-running war in U.S. history, to train and assist Afghan troops in fighting the Taliban. About 5,000 troops are assisting the Iraqi army against ISIS, while another 500 Special Forces fighters are leading the battle against ISIS in Syria. In Yemen, the U.S. has been targeting al-Qaeda in the Arab Peninsula and helping Saudi Arabia fight a proxy war against Iranian-backed rebels. In Libya, the Pentagon sent two B-2 bombers to take out suspected ISIS camps just a day before Trump's inauguration. In addition to those combat theaters, the U.S. has bases scattered around the globe, including in South Korea, Turkey, Japan, Djibouti, Saudi Arabia, Germany, and Spain. So far, the Trump administration has given mixed signals about whether it plans to escalate existing conflicts and about who is setting policy. Our government continues to be in unbelievable turmoil, General Tony Thomas, head of the Military Special Operations Command, said last week. I hope they sort it out soon because we're a nation at war. What's happening in Yemen? There's a civil war going on in the small Arab country between the Iran-backed Shiite Houthi rebels and the Saudi Arabia-backed Sunni Yemeni government. The U.S. is providing support for the Saudi-led coalition, mostly in the form of refueling for the Saudi aircraft pounding suspected militants. It has drawn criticism for that support as civilian casualties mount, particularly after Saudi airstrikes that hit a wedding party and a funeral and killed 300 civilians. Direct U.S. involvement in Yemen has mostly taken the form of drone strikes targeting the extremely active al-Qaeda affiliate base there, such as the 2011 strike that killed American-born cleric Anwar al-Awlaki. After President Trump's ground strike on al-Qaeda commander there last month degenerated into a protracted firefight, killing a Navy SEAL and 23 civilians as well as a dozen militants, Yemen asked for a reassessment of U.S. ground raids. The Trump administration insists that operation was a success, but has not indicated whether it will alter existing U.S. policy toward Yemen's civil war. What about ISIS? The U.S. is taking a lead role in the fight against what's left of the Islamic State in Syria, Iraq, and part of Libya. Last year, the U.S. bombed ISIS strongholds in Libya, including the key port of Sirte, for weeks. In Iraq, U.S. troops have been embedded with the Iraqi army as it tries to retake Mosul from ISIS. But Iraqi lawmakers say Trump has endangered that relationship. The president is reportedly considering deploying ground troops to Syria to speed up the efforts to destroy ISIS, and has also said he'd like to coordinate military efforts with Russia. Analysts say that Russia is truly not fighting ISIS in Syria, but instead has deployed most of its troops, air power and equipment to shore up President Bashar al-Assad in his civil war with various militias, including Kurdish militias allied with the U.S. What's the status of Afghanistan? The 8,400 U.S. troops in Afghanistan maintain bases to support the Afghan government and assist the Afghans in fighting a continuing Taliban insurgency. The Pentagon has asked for more troops to help train Afghan forces, and Trump reportedly told Afghan President Ashraf Ghani in a phone call that he was considering a troop surge. The U.S. commander in Afghanistan, General John W. Nicholson, said this month that the Taliban currently controls more Afghan territory than at any time since 2001. He said the fight there is in a stalemate because the Taliban fighters can easily find sanctuary in neighboring Pakistan and mounts attacks from bases there. What about North Korea? The Stalinist dictatorship, which has been building an arsenal of nuclear bombs, just tested a new intermediate-range missile. The missile shows technical elements that indicate North Korea is closer to creating an intercontinental ballistic missile that could reach the U.S. mainland with a nuclear warhead. In January, Trump tweeted that an operational North Korean ICBM won't happen, but he made no direct statement about the February test. However, Trump has said in the past that he would pressure China to rein in its rogue client state. China has control, absolute control, over North Korea, he said, and they should make that problem disappear. China, however, has always been reluctant to intervene in North Korea and already has much friction with the Trump administration over trade, Taiwan, and Beijing's territorial claim over the South China Sea. China, for its part, says Trump should deal directly with Pyongyang. We believe, said Foreign Ministry spokesman Jin Shuang, that dialogue and consultation offer the way out. Looking at the columns now, we'll take two from the U.S. The first, Obamacare's lasting impact. After 7 years of voting to repeal Obamacare dozens of times, why are Republicans finding it so agonizing to come up with a replacement? Asked Eugene Robinson. Simple. Obamacare was a huge success. It's not that the program wasn't flawed. Costs to some middle-class people were too high, and many insurance companies lost money, largely because Republicans did everything possible to sabotage the program. Obamacare succeeded, however, by fundamentally changing the health care debate in this country. Republicans had always insisted health care was just another commodity, which you could either afford to buy or could not. Thanks to Obamacare, however, access to affordable health care is now seen as a right for all Americans, and government is seen as the guarantor of that right. Republicans who once denounced Obamacare as socialism are now frantically scrambling and failing to find ways to preserve its highly popular provisions, such as affordable policies for people with pre-existing conditions. If the plan Republicans finally agree upon does take health care away from millions of people or forces them to spend a lot more on it, they will pay a grievous political price, and Barack Obama will have the last laugh. The return of the Whig Party. History doesn't repeat itself, said Jeff Jacoby, but it has an unnerving tendency to rhyme. As President Trump turns Washington on its head, it's a good time to look back on another divisive chief executive from New York, Millard Fillmore. When Fillmore became our 13th president upon Zachary Taylor's death in 1850, he immediately plunged the nation into turmoil. Fillmore was hostile toward immigrants and free trade, supported slavery, and was drawn to conspiracy theories. His first act was to fire every member of Taylor's cabinet, which he resented for having ignored him when he was vice president. Fillmore vigorously enforced the repugnant Fugitive Slave Act, allowing escaped slaves to be hunted down like animals. He also denounced northern communities that vowed to resist the law and even charged 41 Americans with treason for refusing to join a slave-catching posse. After Fillmore lost the 1852 election in a landslide, his fractured Whig Party collapsed. In 1856, Fillmore ran for president on the nativist Know-Nothing ticket with the slogan, "Americans must rule America." Today, Fillmore is deservedly lost in obscurity, but his politics have made a comeback. And this from Russia. Second thoughts on celebrating Trump. We can put away the champagne now, said Maxim Trudolyubov. President Trump is apparently not going to be the Russia-friendly sanctions-lifting U.S. leader that so many Russians had expected. Ever since Trump was forced to dump his national security advisor, Michael Flynn, over alleged improper contacts with Russia's ambassador to the U.S., the Trump administration has lurched into anti-Russian overdrive. Over the past week, administration officials have accused Russia of interfering in Western elections, urged NATO to ramp up defense spending, and even demanded that Russia return Crimea to Ukraine. Obviously, Trump is under tremendous pressure to appear tough on Russia. At this point, it's hard to imagine the president has any flexibility in negotiations, as his every move will be under a microscope. Now that Trump has been revealed to be so ineffectual, the bromance is over, between him and President Putin, said Ivan Tufsky in RussianDirect.org. Rumor has it that the Kremlin recently ordered state TV to stop kowtowing to Trump. That's bad news for ordinary Russians. The Kremlin had been exploiting the obsession with Trump, making the U.S. president the main news topic to distract Russians from current day-to-day economic problems and bring more drama into their lives. What will fill that void now? Some experts fear the Kremlin may invent a new, short, victorious war. It could even ratchet up tensions with NATO in order to reinvigorate the besieged fortress narrative ahead of Russia's 2018 presidential election. And that would be extremely dangerous for the entire international security systems. The West's growing sense of insecurity heightens those risks, said Fyodor Lukyanov. In contrast to the smugness of the Obama years, the Americans under Trump are in a period of self-doubt. They are in a panic over alleged Russian intervention in their elections, and their fear has infested Western European countries that have upcoming elections, notably France and Germany. People across the West point to a strange cocktail of hackers, trolls, Russia's English language RT TV channel, and so-called fake news, a new name for disinformation, as proof of Russia's supposed omnipotence. At the same time, they portray their own societies as totally defenseless and vulnerable. Will Trump, with his fragile ego, overcompensate? The unpredictability is dangerous for us all. And we're on to the last word, our in-depth article. America's improbable pillow king. Mike Lindell was an insomniac with a crack cocaine addiction when the idea for the world's best pillow came to him in a dream, said writer Josh Dean. Last year, his sales hit $280 million. As so many great entrepreneurial success stories do, the tale of Mike Lindell begins in a crack house. It was the fall of 2008, and the then 47-year-old divorced father of four from the Minneapolis suburbs had run out of crack again. He had been up for either 14 or 19 days, trying to save his struggling startup and making regular trips into the city to visit his dealer, Ty. This time, Lindell arrived at Ty's apartment and received a shock instead. The dealer refused his business. Ty wasn't going to sell him any more crack until he ended his binge. He'd also called the two other dealers Lindell used and ordered them to do the same. Many people would be ashamed to tell this story. Lindell tells it all the time. I was like, wow, drug dealers care, he says. The moment wasn't the end of his drug abuse, which started in his 20s when he owned bars and stretched through the early years of MyPillow, the Chaska, Minnesota company he founded in 2005 to fulfill his dream of making the world's best pillow. It was, however, his low point. It was when he vowed to get better. The story is impossible to confirm. Ty isn't reachable for comment, but it's become part of Lindell's legend. 8-plus years later, Lindell is sober and phenomenally successful. He quit everything, alcohol, powdered cocaine, and crack, after one final party on January 16, 2009, and presides over an empire that's still growing precipitously. Last year, he opened a second factory, saw sales rise from $115 million to $280 million, and almost tripled his workforce to 1,500. To date, he sold more than 26 million pillows at $45 and up, a huge number of them directly to consumers who call and order by phone after seeing or hearing one of his inescapable TV and radio ads. On this day in early November, he's just back from a week in New York, spent celebrating the election of Donald Trump. He spent the morning catching up on business with various employees who cycle in and out. "This is my head of IT, Jennifer Pauley," Lindell says, as a young woman pops in. "She's a good example of me taking my employees and knowing their skills. I have a house painter in charge of all my maintenance at the factory. Jennifer is self-taught. Did you ever go to school for IT? I took some Microsoft classes, but that's basically it," she says. "I knew how to run a spreadsheet, and that's why he trusted me with data." Lindell laughs loudly. He wears two discreet hearing aids, but everyone says he's been boisterous forever. "God's given me a gift to be able to put people in the right position where their strengths are," he says. Next, Heather Luth, Lindell's oldest daughter, the company's graphic designer, comes in to talk about the latest email campaigns. "MyPillow is," someone at the company told me, "more a family forest than a family tree." Lindell's brother, Corey, who invested at one of MyPillow's lowest points, is now the second largest shareholder. His job? Doing essentially whatever. Today he's fixing a grandfather clock. Larry Kading, director of manufacturing, calls from the new factory in nearby Shakopee to discuss whether or not to make 30,000 pillows for Costco that the store hasn't asked for yet. Lindell's vote? Go for it. "You're always juggling stuff like that," he says. He's an unusual manager, governing largely on instinct and by making seemingly wild gambles that he swears are divinely inspired. "We don't use PowerPoints," he says. "I end up getting stuff in prayer." The pillow came to him in a dream. This was 2003. Lindell owned a pair of successful bars outside Minneapolis and enjoyed the lifestyle a bit too much. He was, he said, a very functional drug user with four kids and a nice house. He helped with homework, took the family on vacation, and was a decent father and husband, other than the fact that he used cocaine. Throughout his life, he'd sought the perfect pillow. He never slept well, and things kept happening to worsen the problem. He got sciatica. He was in a bad car accident. He nearly died while skydiving after nearly dying while motorcycling on his way to skydiving. He got addicted to cocaine. When he did sleep, it was fitful. "That's one of the problems with cocaine," he says, seemingly without irony. One morning, after he woke, or maybe he was still up, he can't recall, he sat at the kitchen table and wrote, "My Pillow," over and over until he'd sketched the rough logo for a product that didn't exist. When his daughter Lizzie came through and saw him maniacally scribbling the same word over and over, like Jack Nicholson in The Shining, she asked what he was doing. "I'm going to invent the best pillow the world has ever seen," he exclaimed. "It's going to be called My Pillow." The only way Lindell was ever happy with a pillow was when he found a way to, in his words, micro-adjust an existing one. It would typically be foam. He'd yank and pull the filling apart and break up the inside, then arrange and pile up the torn foam like a mouse building a nest until it was the right height for his neck. Then he'd sleep. By morning, it would be all messed up again. When Lindell imagined his perfect pillow, it was micro-adjustable, but would keep its shape all night. He bought every variety of foam and then asked his two sons to sit on the deck of the house with him and tear the foam into different sized pieces that they'd stuff into prototypes for testing. Day after day, they did this until Lindell settled on a mix of three sizes of foam, a pebble, a dime, and a quarter, roughly. When he stuffed just the right amount of that mixture into a case and smushed it around to the shape he wanted, it held that shape. It was perfect. Lindell believed this pillow would change lives. He made 300 and went in search of buyers, stopping at every big box retailer in the area. I said I had the best pillow ever made. How many would you like? You can imagine how that went. When someone suggested he try a mall kiosk, Lindell borrowed $12,000 to rent one for 6 weeks, starting in the middle of November 2004. He sold his first pillow the first day, and it was, he says, the most amazing feeling. But he'd priced the product too low. His cost was more than the retail price. Plus, his pillow was too big for standard pillowcases. The kiosk failed. He borrowed more money against the house and also from friends who weren't sick of him yet. When desperate, he counted cards at the blackjack table to pay for materials. Eventually, all the casinos within a day's drive banned him. The day after he closed the kiosk, he got a call from one of the few customers who declared, "This pillow changed my life." This enthusiastic buyer ran the Minneapolis Home and Garden Show, one of the largest for home products in the country. He wanted Lindell to have a booth. Lindell took 300 pillows. This time they were a standard size and sold them all. He also got himself invited to take a spot at the Minneapolis State Fair and sold well. This was a revelation. There were dozens of home and garden shows around the country and countless more fairs. "Those are your testing grounds," he said. "A product that works at the fair works, period." For the next few years, this is basically how the company operated. Lindell and a few key salespeople drove around in trucks stuffed full of pillows to sell at fairs. They were all effective, but no one's pitch, sermon was more like it, moved the merch like Lindell's. He didn't give up the drugs. His habit continued. His 20-year marriage broke up, and he lost his house because he was constantly borrowing money to pay his suppliers. He was barreling toward that moment with Ty, the dealer. Finally, he had one last blowout and quit cold turkey. "I knew if I waited one more day, it would be over," he says. Lindell knew the best way to sell his pillow was to present his story live, as he'd been doing at shows since 2005. He decided to make an infomercial. His friends thought he was nuts. The spot opened with Lindell in a satiny blue button-down that's now his trademark garment, saying, "Don't change that channel because the next half hour is going to change your life." He just ad-libbed, saying, for instance, that down pillows were the worst thing that ever happened to America, and that my pillow was so malleable that you can fold it up into little balloon animals. The half-hour infomercial aired for the first time on October 7th, 2011, at 3 a.m. on the East Coast. The business went straight up, Lindell says. He hired everyone he could find, literally off bar stools sometimes, and put them to work answering phones or sewing on machines that he stuffed into every corner of a local bus garage lent to him by a friend. In 6 months, he grew from 50 to 500 employees and sold almost $100 million in pillows. But Lindell never bothered to figure out his indirect costs. He didn't really even know what those were. Checks were flying off his desk, more and more of them to pay for the infomercial spots, with no way to know which ones were working and which ones were just wasted money. He was losing $250,000 a week. What saved the entrepreneur was FedEx. It hadn't occurred to him to negotiate shipping rates. He just paid retail with a bunch of different shippers. A company rep came in, asked about his cost, and offered him a rate so low he couldn't believe it. "Wow," Lindell said, "you can do this?" Overnight, a red number turned black. Walking through the factory, Lindell shows off his newest products, a dog bed and a mattress topper. Then he points out a section of the building where returns are handled. "Fewer than 3% of my pillow buyers return products," he says, "and less than 1/20 of 1% of those return a product twice." Lindell obsesses over customer satisfaction. If a customer is on hold for more than a few minutes, he gets an alert on his phone. He expects customer emails to be answered within minutes, and if a queue builds up, he gets an alert about that too. He often handles hundreds of minutes of calls per month himself. For years, MyPillow was advertised as the cure for almost every sleep problem, as well as many health ailments. Ads boasted that using one could alleviate fibromyalgia, joint pain, and restless leg syndrome, as well as promote delta sleep, the most restorative phase of the sleep cycle. Early last fall, Lindell settled with 10 California district attorneys who sued MyPillow for false advertising, arguing that these claims had no scientific backing. The company denied any wrongdoing, but agreed to pay $1 million to settle and to remove those claims from any advertising in California. The California suit was briefly embarrassing, but seems to have had no lingering effects. It certainly hasn't hurt sales or Lindell's enthusiasm. The new factory could run faster and soon will, he says. MyPillow could push production up to more than 85,000 pillows a day. To get there, he says, all he needs to do is buy more media. He says that what he calls the tsunami, the next boom in sales, the one that will lead to $1 billion, started last fall. The election was just another harbinger. Two women who did merchandising for the Trump campaign have stopped by for a tour and have been tailing our group. They seem in awe of the scale and efficiency here, from an essentially flat and somewhat chaotic-seeming organization ruled by a single outlandish man. What's the largest sales month you've ever had, one asks. MyPillow is always the biggest we've ever been on the day you're standing here, Lindell replies. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in Bloomberg Businessweek. I'm going to read one of the business articles for you this week. It's titled, Health Insurance. Can HSAs help replace Obamacare? The health saving account is having its moment, said Chris Mamula in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. As Republicans debate how to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, two things look certain. Consumers will shoulder a bigger share of health care costs in the future, and any GOP health care plan will heavily rely on HSAs. The accounts, which are usually paired with high-deductible health insurance plans, allow people to set aside money tax-free to pay for medical expenses not covered by health insurance, such as co-pays and deductibles. HSAs have grown in popularity since they were introduced in 2003, and some 30% of employers now offer an HSA-eligible health insurance plan. Republicans want to expand the use of these savings accounts because they see them as an effective tool to drive down the overall health care expenditure. When consumers have to spend their own money rather than an insurer's, HSA advocates argue, they're more likely to search for better, cheaper care options. Every GOP health care plan under consideration would dramatically expand the use of HSAs, said Julie Appleby in CNN.com. This year, contributions to the saving accounts are capped at $3,400 for an individual and $6,750 for a family. House Speaker Paul Ryan's plan would raise the HSA contribution limit to match the total of the participant's annual health insurance deductible and out-of-pocket maximum. Senator Rand Paul's plan would remove caps entirely and allow HSAs to be offered with any type of insurance, not just high-deductible plans. But critics point out that raising contribution limits benefits only those who can afford to contribute large sums. And while money invested in an HSA grows tax-free, similar to a 401k retirement fund, older or sicker consumers could blow through their entire fund every year and never accumulate any savings. Studies do suggest that people with HSAs use less health care than those without such plans, said Jillian White in TheAtlantic.com. But there's little evidence that this behavior is good for their health. Patients sometimes forgo medical care while waiting for their accounts to build up. One study of high-deductible plans found that rather than shopping around for the best and cheapest treatment, many individuals simply opted for less medical care, including the types of preventative care that could result in fewer medical emergencies and financial shocks later on. For HSAs to truly succeed, we all need to change our mindset, said April Fulton in NPR.org. We like to think of our future selves as healthier and more financially secure, when in fact health and income both tend to decline with age. Our refusal to recognize that reality is one reason that half of Americans don't have a retirement account. If those people won't or can't put aside money for their old age, will they really save for an unforeseen health crisis? We're on the health and science page now. Pollution in the world's deepest waters. In a sign that even the most remote and inaccessible places on Earth are not immune to human activity, high levels of toxic pollution have been discovered in the deepest waters on the planet. British researchers used robotic submarines to retrieve small crustaceans from the Mariana Trench in the Western Pacific and the Kermadec Trench north of New Zealand, both of which are more than 6 miles deep. When they analyzed these hardy critters, they found they were contaminated with levels of toxic chemicals up to 50 times higher than those species that survive in China's most heavily polluted rivers. The contaminants were persistent organic pollutants, or POPs, industrial chemicals that can take decades to break down. Many POPs, including one that was discovered in every sample taken for the study, have been outlawed since the late 1970s because of their links to cancer. The study's lead author, Alan Jameson from Newcastle University, says it wasn't a surprise to find the chemicals in the deepest parts of the ocean. Once the toxic particles reach the sea, currents and gravity disperse them rapidly. But he says the sky-high level of contamination was unexpected and worrisome. We still think of the deep ocean as being this remote and pristine realm, safe from human impact, he tells The Guardian. Our research shows that, sadly, this could not be further from the truth. In the health scare of the week, snowstorms and heart attacks. Big snowstorms may increase a man's risk for a fatal heart attack, reports Reuters.com. Canadian researchers examined records on about 130,000 hospital admissions in Quebec during the winters between 1981 and 2014 and compared them with weather reports over the same period. They found that men were up to 16% more likely to have a heart attack and as much as 34% more likely to die from one after a big snowstorm. The longer the storm and the more snow that fell, the greater the risk. Since there wasn't a similar uptick for women, the researchers speculate that the connection is probably linked to shoveling out snow. It may be that men shovel more than women, particularly after heavy snowfall, said study author Natalie Auger from the University of Montreal. It is also possible that men put more effort into shoveling and have a tendency to overdo it. Frigid temperatures combined with a physical exertion required for shoveling can be dangerous, the study warns, particularly for those who are out of shape or who have pre-existing heart conditions. We're on the talking points page now. Trump, the sanity question. Is the 45th president of the United States mentally ill? In the month since the election, says Robert Al-Abkarian in the Los Angeles Times, Donald Trump's mental state has become an issue of fierce public debate. Senator Al Franken claimed that several Republican colleagues have admitted they're concerned about the president's well-being. Other Democratic lawmakers have raised the prospect of invoking the 25th Amendment, under which a president can be declared incapacitated and removed from office. The psychiatrist who defined narcissistic personality disorder reacted to the speculation by saying that the president couldn't be diagnosed as mentally ill because he causes severe distress rather than experiencing it. Then came the bizarre press conference last week when Trump repeated several blatant falsehoods and went on a series of angry tirades. The man is clearly kind of crazy, but is he crazy crazy? I don't know about crazy, but Trump is clearly not well, said Jacob Bacharach in NewRepublic.com. At that alarming press conference, the president seemed unhinged, making faces and doing silly voices, badly stating falsehoods about his electoral college margin, and referring offhandedly to blowing up a Russian ship and to nuclear holocaust. It was all quite bonkers. Actually, it's Trump's critics who've lost their minds, said Keith Abloh in FoxNews.com. This is a man who has acquired billions of dollars through complex real estate transactions, built his name into a worldwide brand, and beat 16 Republicans and Democrats to win the presidency. Could he have achieved all that if he were mentally unstable? Trump is stone-cold sane. Please, enough with the armchair diagnoses, said Olivia Goldhill in QZ.com. Not only does all this baseless speculation stigmatize people suffering from genuine mental illness, it's also impossible to diagnose people without examining them in person. Indeed, the American Psychiatric Association actually prohibits its members from commenting on a public figure's mental health. There's another reason we should avoid psychiatrically labeling our leaders, said Richard Friedman in the New York Times. It lets them off the moral hook. You can be vain, mean, and incompetent without being mentally ill, and the nation doesn't need a shrink to help it decide whether President Trump is fit to serve. All we need is common sense. DNC, Democrats at a crossroads. More than 3 months after a devastating presidential election loss, Democrats are finally getting ready to settle on a new leader, said Caitlin Huey Burns in RealClearPolitics.com. This week, 447 Democratic National Committee members will gather in Atlanta to select their next chairperson in what will be a soul-searching exercise for a party consigned to minority status at every level of government. The frontrunners represent a proxy campaign between the Obama coalition, in the person of former Labor Secretary Tom Perez, and the leftist Bernie Sanders wing, represented by Minnesota Representative Keith Ellison. A dark horse candidate, South Bend, Indiana Mayor Peter Brutgig, 35, is offering himself as a fresh-faced alternative. The key questions facing the party are these. Can it turn the anti-Trump mass protests around the country into an effective political movement? And can Democrats win back disaffected Rust Belt voters? To win national elections, Democrats need to fire up millennials, said Miles Howard in WBUR.org. That's why the party should pick Ellison. Young voters saw Clinton as too cozy with the big money establishment and believed the DNC rigged the primary against Sanders. Ellison has been an aggressive champion of the working class, minorities, and young people, and has Sanders' full-throated support. Democrats should be more progressive, not less, said Steve Phillips in the New York Times. Clinton didn't lose because the white working class backed Trump. She lost because 503,000 more voters in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania chose the Libertarian and Green Party candidates in 2016 than in 2012. Clinton lost those three states and the election by just 78,000 votes. Democrats must reclaim their progressive base rather than embark on an ill-fated quest to win over culturally conservative whites. When the Democrats learn their lesson, when will the Democrats learn their lesson, asked Alexandra DeSantis in NationalReview.com. By choosing Ellison or Perez, one a radically progressive representative, the other a radically progressive former federal bureaucrat, they overlook Buttigieg, who can appeal to their base and the working class. A veteran of Afghanistan from a heartland state, he'd be a crucial asset for a party hopelessly disconnected from middle America. Buttigieg is also a gay man elected twice in a state that skews decidedly to the religious right, said Erica Smith in the Sacramento Bee. He'd be the smartest choice. Not that I'm convinced anyone who really matters is listening. And a couple of shorter notes. The cost of providing travel and security for President Trump and his family on various trips have exceeded $11 million in a month, including three weekend trips to Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort and trips taken by his sons Eric and Donald Jr. to promote the family business abroad. In addition, it cost about $500,000 a day to provide security to Melania and Barron Trump while they live in Trump Tower. During President Obama's 8 years in office, his travel expenses totaled $97 million, a figure Trump could surpass in a year. Los Angeles was the most congested city in the world last year, with the average driver wasting 104 hours sitting in traffic in the city in 2016. Moscow and New York City came in second and third. And we'll finish out the hour today with a quote from Mike Tyson, quoted in Fortune.com. He says, "Everyone has a plan until they get punched in the mouth." And with that, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the week. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.